The next case is State versus Sundiata Akoli. As you can see, the Chief Justice will not be participating in this case. May we please have the appearance of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Afrin appearing for Sundiata Akoli.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Attorney General Stephanie Cohen appearing on behalf of the New Jersey State Parole Board.
Very good.
Good morning, Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honor. Raymond Brown of Pashman Stein appearing on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Thank you. May be seated. We have a number of amici. We're happy to have you here, but we also invite you, when appropriate, to adopt the position of parties rather than restate them. Don't mean to inhibit your argument. We'll begin with Mr. Afrin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I stand before you representing Sundiata Akoli, who is asking this court to vacate the majority decision below and direct an order of release, obviously subject to the conditions of parole later being established through the board's normal process. In a sense, we also ask that you restore the original unanimous decision because the record in substance has not changed since that decision. The Attorney General, my friend Mr. Josephson, not Ms. Cohen, who's here today, conceded at the appellate division that the only difference in the two records was the friendly fire comment. I'd like to begin by making a statement.
Keep your voice up, please.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I couldn't gauge between under the glass. I'd like to note that this is not what some people might think a political appeal, and it's not a liberal case that many people might think. It's actually a conservative case. Because what's really at issue is the question of the rule of law in New Jersey that governs parole. We're really looking at a question of whether the board, and ultimately the courts, of course, adhere to the legislative directive as to how parole shall be conducted. The 1979 Act was very consciously implemented by the legislature for one reason, to literally narrow the discretion of the board. And to flip the burden of proof. Formerly, the inmate had to demonstrate fitness for release. Now, the board must demonstrate through substantiated facts, through what the legislation calls a preponderance of the evidence, a substantial likelihood of recidivism. And the legislature did not rely on the word likelihood of recidivism. After all, anyone could have a likelihood of a future crime. It wants a substantial likelihood. It wants the preponderance of the evidence to demonstrate that, not merely some piece of evidence that could possibly show that. So there's a very high standard imposed on the board. And what we have in this particular case is a situation in which the board has really not met that standard in any reasonable fashion. In a way, and I hesitate to say this, but I feel that I must, there is a backstory to this case. There's no question of the gravity of the crime, and there's no question of the tragedy that ensued. But anger among the board, or in some cases vengeance, or in some cases a desire not to let a cop killer out, cannot ever be the guidance for an agency. The legislature mandates, and this court has mandated, that there must be proof by factual evidence of a preponderance of the evidence of a substantial likelihood. And what does the board bring to that? The only change between the unanimous decision and the majority decision with Judge Rothstadt's dissent was, as Mr. Josephson said below, the friendly fire comment. And that change the board relied upon as a way to find a justification to deny parole, despite the overwhelming decision prior to that on the unanimous board, unanimous panel. Mr. Coley, for 25 years in these hearings, has always said he did not kill the officer. He said he does not know how he died. In the last hearing, he said 12 times, I don't know. Then finally, Member Jefferson says, I don't care what you know, tell me what you think. And when told to conjecture, He then says he died probably, or I think, from friendly fire. Now, that's wrong. But he didn't initiate that. He never wanted to come up with an excuse. He always said, I didn't do this. And the prosecutor himself says he may not have done this. It may have been done by someone in the car. He was convicted of murder. It doesn't eliminate responsibility. But the board has always denied parole, primarily because he says, I didn't do it. And we now know the prosecutor agrees he may not have done it. And the friendly fire comment does not document any substantial change in his position. He was conjecturing when ordered by Member Jefferson. The board says, well, we have insights from Ms. Van Pelt's, Dr. Van Pelt's report, but does not identify them. The majority below said, well, there was new insight from Van Pelt, but it did not identify him, nor could it, because the board never did. This cannot be a basis for an administrative decision when the board itself won't identify those relevant facts. In fact, Dr. Van Pelt conjectures herself. She says, well, Mr. Coley may condone passively violence on a local or global basis. I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds like he may have an opinion that endorses some other people's violence. That's not a basis for denial of parole. He may have an opinion someday. She doesn't even identify why she says that. She doesn't say he said anything to indicate that. She says he may still actively seek change in his community. Well, I think all of us became lawyers in part to do just that. There's nothing wrong with that. The board says, well, he lacks depth, he lacks genuineness. His answers seem forced. This is the type of discretion the legislature was trying to narrow. When the board uses those metrics, it can deny or grant parole in its full discretion anytime it wants. If an inmate speaks too slowly, his answers are forced. They're not in depth. He lacks tonality. If an inmate speaks too eagerly, it's rehearsed. He's too quick to answer. And the board, by these standards, reserves for itself the literal power to grant or deny parole in its unfettered discretion. A colleague of ours, who I won't name, said that judicial deference is an act of reason, not an act of faith. In other words, the board must give factual reasons that can be tested by analysis, not reasons that are opaque to examination, which is really what has happened here. The board makes an incredible statement. It says, well, he may find himself faced with future charged situations. He's lived in federal prisons for 40 years. He was in a state prison for a few years before, a total of 47 years confinement. He's lived with among the most dangerous felons in the federal system. He has never once been charged with a fight, never once been charged with possessing a weapon, not even a sharpened spoon. His cell has probably been inspected thousands of times, and there has never been any contraband charge of this nature. Never once was he in a confrontation with a staff member or another inmate. He has lived through the most charged situation a human being can, and yet the board says, well, we deny parole because he may yet be faced with charged situations. The board also says he's had insufficient problem resolution. It doesn't say what he needs to do to overcome that. They've said this 8 times now since the mid-1990s. Every psychologist who's reviewed this case has said he has no psychological morbidity. Gorwitz said no contraindication psychologically to release. The federal authorities say the same thing. Van Pelt never concluded that he had any morbidity from a psychological point of view. And the board continues to say insufficient problem resolution. He passed self-induced counseling. He has met every possible psychological metric, and yet the board won't say what more he needs to do. He's taken 150 courses, some more than once. When Dr. Gorwitz interviewed him and was leaving, a staff member at the prison actually ran after her, if you recall this from the briefs, and wanted to tell her what a diligent student he was in class. Now, how many inmates have a staff member of a federal prison run after the state psychologist to say what a worthy student this inmate has been? This man has been an inmate on honor inmate. He's been a peer leader. He's assigned to counsel other inmates. He teaches the federal course in avoiding recidivism. And yet the board, despite all of this, continues to say there's a substantial likelihood of future crime. This man is 85 years old. In 26 years, he's not had one violation, not even being late to work. For 2 years, from 94 to 96, he had minor violations, and I think he went 10 years earlier without a single violation. He did attempt to escape in 1979, I believe it was. That was his last act of irregularity. After that, he became literally a model inmate. Not a single offense, not a single crime, not a single violation in decades. And yet the board says he's not yet fit to be trusted not to commit future crime. The board looks to his philosophical perspective of the entire 286-page transcript. Virtually all of it is devoted to Marx and Engels and the early movement he joined. At one point, I was shocked to read in one of the amicus briefs, and I didn't notice this, that he was asked, well, where does your name come from, Okolie, the name he adopted? And many, many African-American inmates do Africanize their names. In fact, David Ben-Gurion, if you may recall, did that when he moved to Israel as a young man. Many people do that. And he was asked, well, where does this name come from? And he says it comes from one of the tribal nations in Uganda. The immediate response of the board member was, are they violent? Now, in Uganda has 50 million people. A tribal nation in Uganda is as large as New Jersey. And the board member says to Mr. Okolie, is this tribal nation you've taken your name from violent? As if millions of people are somehow violent because they come from Africa. This is the level of inquiry the board descended to. Was this a reasoned analysis? Or was this an arbitrary analysis? 12 pages of this transcript are devoted to things other than the facts of the early crime. At one point, the board asks, tell us what you took away from the criminal thinking course you took. That was 1994.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Was the course critical thinking? Was this mistranscribed? I've looked at the number of courses that he's taken, and I saw that critical thinking was one of them, but in the transcript, I see it's referred to as criminal thinking. Can you shed any light on that? Now, the only reason why I asked you that question is because so many questions were asked about whether he could recall what he learned from the criminal thinking course.
Right. I apologize for sounding a bit out of breath, out of deference to, I think, Your Honor's request to keep my voice up. I'm shouting a bit, so I'm sorry.
No, appreciate it. Thank you.
I noticed that, Your Honor, myself. And at a certain point, I weighed, how do I describe this in the brief? I think it has both names. I think there was an earlier version of the course, and there's a later name. But I think it's substantially the same course. There were many, many questions devoted to it. And, you know, his answer was very general. I don't even remember what he said, frankly, from the brief. He said something to the effect, well, you have to learn to avoid behaviors that lead to things, or words to that effect. And the board criticizes this as lacking depth and lacking an adequate takeaway from the course. It was 22 years earlier. He's, at that point, 81 years old. The board may not have known it, but he had some early dementia. How many of us could remember a CLE course and the details of it from 25 years earlier? Could any of us taking, say, a trust and estate course in New Brunswick 20 years ago, 22 years ago, remember more than a generalized statement? I doubt that. And yet we're expecting this man in his 80s to be able to give some sort of discussion. What counts is not what he remembers from a course 22, 23, 24 years ago, but what he has done in his life in prison. In many ways, this has become a worthy man. He's had opportunities to commit crime, opportunities to be in confrontations, opportunities to be assaulted, verbally at least, to staff. He has never done so. He has opportunities to incite if he was a political revolutionary still. He's never done so. He's never been accused of doing anything other than be an obedient inmate. In fact, Mr. Courtney, his counselor, when asked by Dr. Van Pelt, would you look to Mr. Okolie if there was trouble on the unit? You may remember what he said. He said, I would consider him to be an old man in the way.
Mr. Afrin, you're claiming that the appellate division decision and the parole board's decision are in contravention of our Trantino decision.
Yes.
Could you expand on that?
Yes, certainly. The Trantino decision requires a factual analysis to demonstrate how the board proves the individual is a substantially likely recidivist. Trantino and Cosman and Sisteri, the whole constellation of these cases, require the focus to be on who the inmate has become, not the facts of the early, long ago case, because that's a legislative directive. If we were to look at the early case, virtually nobody who has a life sentence could ever be paroled, because all of those cases are terrible. They result in, they are grave crimes, many, many horrendous, many involving cruelty. So if we were to look at, if our focus were to be the crime, nobody would get paroled. And the legislature wants a different analysis. And I think that's what Trentino says. In many ways, this case is very similar to Trentino, factually. You know, the court made a point of saying Trentino seems to function more as staff than as an inmate. Now, Mr. Coley,
Trentino doesn't exclude discussion of the original offense, does it?
No, of course not, but it doesn't permit a focus to be almost entirely upon that. The focus has to be much more in other directions.
There were questions asked, and some of them you've already alluded to, about his current state.
There were maybe 5 or 6 questions out of literally 600 or 700. If Your Honor infers that there was a large percent of discussion on that point, I'd have to severely disagree.
No. I mean, we've all read the transcript, yeah. But it's not that topic was skipped. You're saying there wasn't sufficient focus on that.
Well, Your Honor, one could put questions in focusing on this area and then say we didn't skip it. But in substance, if it is such a tiny proportion of the board's focus, I think we have to say, in substance, the board gave lip service.
What you're saying is, under your understanding of the transcript, they were skipped, essentially, because from what you've just said, if you put a few on and say that's a focus, it's not. So essentially, you're suggesting to the court that those types of questions were ignored or skipped by the sheer virtue that there weren't that many of them.
I think, Your Honor, that tends to diminish the point I'm making.
No, I'm trying to understand your point, because you said that there were so few that you can't say that they were skipped, but that's the only reason they were put in. So to me, that tells me that, in your point of view, they were skipped. That was just something put in there to fill in the blanks so that nobody could say that they were skipped.
I think I'd answer that in two ways. To begin with, in substance, they were skipped.
Okay.
Because the real focus should be on his life.
Well, that was my question. So in substance, you believe they were skipped?
I don't think there's any other analysis. I mean, the other problem I would say is that the board's focus has been shown to be on things that really every case has said should not be the focus. The board went into details.
Well, that's another point.
Well, no, but
that's a different point from what I asked you.
No, I understand that, Your Honor, but I do think that it is the second half of this point, because when the board gives what I would call lip service to what should be the inquiry, and then the transcript focuses almost entirely on things that the courts have said should not be the primary focus, I think the question has to be looked at together.
One of the things that Trentino said was that inadequate recollection of the details of the crime.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't quite hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to take that. One of the things that Trentino said was that inadequate recollection of details of the crime cannot alone support the denial of a parole application. Am I correct?
Trentino did say that, and I think it went further and said that the inmate has always had this recollection that was inadequate. And if he's never going to have a different recollection, it would be unjust to make this the basis of denial.
So that was one of the issues in Trentino, because he claimed he couldn't recall the events, and that was being used against him by the parole board.
Without question, and the court did say that can't be the focus. Mr. Okoli has never denied the events. He said he didn't know who killed Trooper Foster or how he died. He says, I didn't do it. And I think the board has hooked on that over these many years.
Actually, he went beyond that, because he said numerous times it was friendly fire in his belief.
With respect, he never said numerous times. He answered that question once in response to Member Jefferson's.
He answered it before that way in a prior hearing, did he not?
I do not recall that. In fact, Mr. Josephson conceded that was a new factor from the prior hearing. He never before mentioned friendly fire. He always said he did not do it. He said he did not know who shot him. And when he speculated that it could have been friendly fire, or that it was, when asked to conjecture, the board calls it conjecture itself. He was simply saying someone else did it, not me. And that's consistent with what he always said. I hope, Your Honor, we're not going to deny parole because of this parsing of little... Sorry?
Well, I didn't hear what you said about...
I said, I hope, Your Honor, that we don't, in this state, deny parole because of small deviations over many hearings that take place. This man has gone through 8 hearings. And so when one does that, there are going to be slight differences.
What you're saying is, when he was asked about his knowledge, he's never deviated. When he was asked, what do you know, he's always said that he was blacked out as a result of this grazing bullet. And the only time he gave anything different was when he was invited to conjecture on what he thought happened. And then he conjectured, because that was the question that was asked of him. And he had no choice but to answer the questions put to him by the board.
When one reads the transcript, it looks like he's ordered to answer it. Remember, he's an inmate. He's sitting in the prison, and he's told, I want to know what you think happened. And he attempted multiple times to say, no, I don't know how it happened. And really, Member Jefferson should not have put him in that position. He'd said at least 12 times that day, I don't know how it happened.
He has said that at every single parole hearing. He's been saying that for decades.
For decades. Even at, I don't recall whether he testified, frankly, but he said this at any point in this case. And the prosecutor, and I think it's very fundamental that we recognize this, the prosecutor also has said it may not have been him who fired, that someone in the car may have done so. And that's directly consistent with his statement that I didn't do it. He never denied the officer was killed in this confrontation. He said, I didn't do it.
Actually, in footnotes in two appellate division opinions.
Yes.
That Chesimard actually might have shot Trooper Forster.
That is exactly what has been said twice, and that comes from the prosecutor's own submission to the board. You know, along these lines, the board actually challenged Mr. Coley at the last hearing on the ballistics in the case. And I think this brings us down to a level of fundamental unfairness. A man who's now in his early 80s, who's not an expert in this, is being asked to recall the ballistics evidence from 47 years earlier. This cannot be a reasoned basis for a parole inquiry. It's not what the legislature intended. With this approach, the board is reserving for itself that very discretion that the legislature decided it should not have, and in narrowing its realm of discretion. And so the board's now finding ways to give it that discretion back. And this is why I say the rule of law is what's fundamental here. Nowhere in the board's finding, outside of conjectural matters such as, well, now he may have changed his story slightly, or he might find himself in those charged situations or may condone passively violence, nowhere is there any finding of fact, actual fact, that could satisfy that preponderance of the evidence standard. And so when I say this is really a conservative case, it's a question of the rule of law. Mr. Coley is without question a despised inmate, in a sense.
Is there any suggestion by the board, like, what sort of crime he would commit?
Your Honor, there was no suggestion. The closest the board came was saying, you may find yourself in future charged situations. Well, any one of us may, frankly. I frequently find myself in that situation with clients. And any one of us may find ourselves in that situation. And the board never identified what kind of crime. And Mr. Coley himself has made the point that, that people who have committed violence because of political views, decades later, never go back to that. I'm not aware of a single case of that.
What was his plan if he were released on parole?
When we started this round, which was 2010, the remands really go back to that record, his plan was to work as a paralegal. A law firm had made an offer. It's in the file. And that was a very legitimate offer. You know, as we know, he's an educated man, and at that time, that was realistic. But he's very much more aged now. He does have early dementia. I speak to him, and he has problems cognitively dealing with a complex question today. He did a lot at the hearing, but now he has difficulty doing that. So that's not realistic. His daughter is an executive at an investment bank, and she plans to house him, assuming we have an interstate compact for the supervision of parole. And she has a very large home with 7 bedrooms in Brooklyn, and she is willing to take him on. He will obviously get some Social Security, but she is well able to financially support him. And that's his plan. He's a retired man at this point. I don't think he works in prison any longer, except in his cell maintenance. And he intends to live with his daughter, who is very well able financially to take care of him. She is being an executive at an investment
bank. Does he have any other medical issues? Did you say that he may have the onset of dementia? I want to make sure I have this correctly. Or
yes.
Problems. Go ahead.
Yes, actually, Dr. Van Pelt noted that, and she observed his memory issues, and Mr. Courtney told her about those problems that he noticed were increasing. And she confirms in her findings that this reviewer noted the same condition. He does have a heart condition. He was very ill from COVID. He actually was sent out of the prison to the local hospital in Maryland. He has had significant post-COVID symptoms, some of those long-term recurring symptoms that can occur, you know, mostly to the very aged or those who are have significant comorbidities. So he's had significant problems with COVID going forward. He certainly has that early dementia, and I think it's growing somewhat worse because cognitively when I speak with him, I can't get him to focus on a more complex issue. He understands when a hearing's coming up, but can't deal with the complexity of an issue. So those are his conditions. You know, he's physically healthy otherwise, but he's declining in many ways.
Stratford, what is this? What is the scope of the board's discretion when it comes to experts who are often at the heart of a parole determination? In other words, if there are competing experts from the from a contemporaneous period or over time, does the board have the discretion to say, we credit expert A and we're not crediting B, C, D?
I think the board has an obligation to look at the full factual record.
Understand. And I'm not referring to reviewing. I think there's no question that the board has the obligation to look at everything in that record.
Your Honor, I don't think any decision has actually addressed the question of whether the board can rely on a latest expert and ignore an earlier expert.
Well, I agree with you. But what is your position with respect to, is it your position, to state it differently, that the board has an obligation to rely upon every expert presented to it?
In my opinion, yes, provided those experts are reasonably contemporaneous with the event. A psychological report from 1994 in this case might not be relevant. But Dr. Gorowitz's report, which came from 2010-11, reflects, I think, the man as he is in his current state of life.
Stepping away from your case, because there are a number of arguments being made about the scope of the discretion of the parole board here. Stepping, and obviously anything that occurs in this case affects future cases. If the board, let's say they're contemporaneous, if the board is given three expert, or two, make it simple, two expert reports that are not entirely on all fours with one another, there's some disagreement between the two of them, can the board say, we look at this one and we look at that one and we credit expert A and rely on expert A, and we are not giving any weight to expert B?
What the board has to do is, number one, identify what in expert A's report it is crediting. It can't simply say we credit new insight from expert A and leave it at that. I mean, or as far back as the Monk decision.
But before you get there, can the parole board decide that it is relying on only one expert and rejecting a competing expert?
No, because it has to look at the relative contemporaneity of the expert report.
I'm not saying it doesn't look at it, Mr. Efron. I'm not saying anybody's leaving things in the waste paper basket. I'm asking you whether it is within the discretion of the board to decide, having looked at both expert reports and heard from the experts, that it does not credit one of those and credits the other.
I think it's Cosman and Sisteri. I think in Cosman and Sisteri, the courts have said that the board cannot ignore an expert report without explaining why it is doing so. So it can't decide, well, Van Pelt has a slightly different take on things, we'll rely on her. Number one, it can't do that without identifying what in her report it's relying on. And number two, it can't do that without explaining why it no longer relies on Gorowitz.
Well, the board never rejected Gorowitz. I mean, Gorowitz did her report, and the case was appealed to this court based upon Gorowitz's report. I believe it was in 2011. And she concluded that there were no psychological contraindications to granting parole.
That's right. And so did the federal authorities at the same time.
And that was the parole board's expert.
It was their expert.
Right.
And they don't mention her name, Your Honor, anywhere
in
the report.
In 2011, right, Accoli to be very cooperative, self-reflective, thoughtful, non-defensive in his responses to the questions posed to him, appeared to be answering honestly, expressed regret and remorse about his involvement in the death of the state trooper. Reading parts of that report, is that correct?
That's exactly what she said. And what's of interest is that in the first decision following that, the board doesn't mention her report. So to begin with, they've ignored their own expert without explaining why. And Cosman and Sisteri, I believe it is, both say they must explain why they ignore the expert.
Even Van Pelt found a low to moderate risk for reoffense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So my question, Can that ever equate into a substantial likelihood of reoffense?
Number one, the word substantial is not there. And secondly, no, because she's finding a low to moderate risk. And actually, the low to moderate, the word moderate, actually comes from the LSIR. But that uses all of the offenses. But there's been case law that says we don't necessarily take all of the offenses from one transaction as separate offenses for the LSIR. So really, it probably is more on the low end, not even approaching moderate, because all of those offenses were part of one single event. I don't mean to make light of it, but when one commits murder, they inevitably commit other offenses. You're possessing a weapon for a felonious purpose. You're committing assault. So the case law says that when we have those single offenses as one transaction, it's not really appropriate to look at all of those in the same way. So although low to moderate is the LSIR, in reality, it's probably a low risk. And also, when one looks at his age and the age crime curve, it's almost unheard of for anyone at that age level to commit any act, much less a violent act. You know, what the board has a duty to explain why it disregards its own expert. And frankly, it doesn't even explain why it accepts Van Pelt's report. It says, well, we have insights from Van Pelt's report. What are those insights? If one looks carefully at Van Pelt, there's nothing in there that can support a substantial likelihood. Really, her comments are speculative. And that's not a basis for denial of parole. I have to say I feel somewhat affronted in a sense because the state comes to the court saying that the board should have held a full evidentiary hearing, which probably should have under the statute, but the board's rules didn't allow it. So this court accepted the legislative intent to have a full hearing. Instead of bringing Dr. Gorewitz back, they bring a new reviewer. And then they say, well, that new reviewer has different insights, but the board won't identify them. It's almost as if this new reviewer is used as a basis to deny parole beyond the existing record. But even the Attorney General below never referred to Van Pelt as a change in the record, but only to the friendly fire remark, because Van Pelt offers nothing of substance to suggest a substantial likelihood. She doesn't even suggest a likelihood.
Mr. Afrin, do you have... I think we're approaching the 30-minute mark. That's okay. Do you, first, any members of the court have any questions? Would you like to sum up?
Certainly. May I have about 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary?
Yes.
I would simply sum up by saying that, to begin with, deference to an agency must be based on the agency's reasoned factual findings. It can't be based on a circumstance where the agency does not make findings of substance. So I don't think there's any basis to remand to the agency, because the agency has had 8 times, and it has still never identified that factual basis. I would say Mr. Okoli is a proper product of our correction system, despite the gravity of the offense. He has lived in one of the worst environments in the world for 40 years without a single offense. After that 1979 escape, without a single violation in almost 30 years. This man has shown he can survive and live productively, peacefully, and within the law, despite the gravity of what he did and despite the early philosophy that led to that. I would ask that he be released in the most expeditious time possible, and I thank the court for its close attention to this.
Thank you very much. Mr. Russo?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. In Trantino 6, this court concluded with these powerful words. If ever courts permit agencies of government to create exceptions to the rule of law, applying it to the many but exempting the disfavored, we will have irreparably damaged the foundation of our democracy. And as noted by Justice Albin and Coley 2, this case is about more than one individual. It is about the integrity of our justice system. Fundamentally, Mr. Coley's case is a test of this court's resolve to hold the parole board accountable to the legal standard set forth in the 1979 Parole Act. That's what fundamentally this case is about. And we know that the 1979 Parole Act significantly changed the 1948 Act, as we discussed in the brief. The underlying goals of the 1979 Parole Act, and the legislative history is critical here, was to have a process that was more objective, more consistent, more predictable, thereby reducing the discretion of the board. Simply put, the board's decision denying parole is not entitled to deference. The board did not correctly apply the legal standards set forth in the 1979 Parole Act. Now, to correctly apply the standard in this case, the board must do the following, which it did not do here. First, the board must start from the standpoint that there's a presumption that Mr. Okoli will be released, not from the standpoint that Mr. Okoli must prove his rehabilitation to be paroled. Not once in the board's decision was it stated, not once, that Mr. Okoli is cloaked with the presumption of release. Second, and this goes to the objective assessment issue, which I'd like to focus on a bit. Second, the sole issue before the board is an objective assessment of whether there's a substantial likelihood that Mr. Okoli will recidivate. Not a subjective assessment, as in the 1948 Act, as to whether or not Mr. Okoli is fit to rejoin society. Mr. Okoli does not have to prove that he is fit to rejoin society to the subjective satisfaction of the board. Third, a substantial likelihood, which Mr. Affron went over in great depth, a substantial likelihood of recidivism is more than a possibility or a potential to recidivate. It means that recidivism is probable, more likely than not. The board never concluded that Mr. Okoli, never concluded on the issue before this court, never concluded that Mr. Okoli is a substantial likelihood to recidivate. Only that concerns remain that he would commit a crime if released. Fourth and finally.
You're referring to the initial decision of the parole board.
I'm referring to, in the appendix 299, the decision of the parole board. That's correct.
You're stating that in that initial decision, there's no mention by the board itself that he was substantially likely to reoffend?
Correct, and I believe that's the 2016 decision, Justice Albin. I quote, concerns remain that he would commit a crime if released. Certainly not close to the standard of the 1979 Parole Act. And fourth and finally, with respect to the standard, the parole board must sustain its heavy burden to deny parole. And that includes two factors, which I think are the essence of this case. The board must establish that the factors which it relies upon have a connection to the risk of recidivism. There must be a connection to the risk of recidivism, and the board must place the greatest weight on factors that are statistically established to have an objective relationship to that risk of recidivism. The board failed this test time and time again. The board's denial was based entirely on lack of insight, denial of offense, and minimization of conduct, none of which are included in the 24 factors for evaluation by the parole board in determining whether an individual should be paroled consistent with the standard. The board failed to offer any evidence linking these non-code factors to a substantial likelihood that Mr. Okoli would recidivate. Indeed, the board did not cite, and Trentino 6 said that this is a big deal, linking the two. The board did not cite any data, studies, or expert reports suggesting that those three non-code factors are correlated with a substantial risk of recidivism. Now, the board has recidivism reports. We talk about it in our brief. The board authors reports on a yearly basis, along with the Department of Corrections and the Juvenile Justice Commission. The board blatantly ignored factors correlated with a low risk of recidivism, as demonstrated by the board's own recidivism reports, including Mr. Okoli's age, his lack of a prior state prison sentence, the length of time he has served in prison, and his LSIR score, which was mentioned by Mr. Afron. I would like to provide two examples, two significant examples of how the board failed to consider objective factors correlated with Mr. Okoli's risk of recidivism. The first example is the age crime curve, and second example is the LSIR, how that was turned on its head. So first, with respect to the age crime curve, the board obsessively focused on the underlying crimes to the exclusion of undisputed statistical evidence related to the age crime curve. The parole board failed to address the powerful connection between age and recidivism. The data clearly shows that prisoners 65 or older, like Mr. Okoli, have a 6.5% risk of being convicted of a new crime and a mere 4.1% chance of being reincarcerated.
Where does that come from? What are your statistics?
That comes from our brief from the, I believe it's the U.S. Sentencing, or a report of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. I think it's around page 30 or 31 of our brief, but also from the recidivism reports themselves. There's correlations between age and crime. Now, I will say, Justice Albin, to be fair, this data is for 65 and older. Now, I don't think there's data for an octogenarian. I would imagine, I would infer, perhaps a bit of speculation, I would infer that at 85-year-old, you're probably dealing with, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 or 2% chance of recidivism. But they only look at 65 and older, and it's a 4.1% chance of being reincarcerated and a 6.5% risk of being convicted of a new crime. Hardly a substantial likelihood of recidivating. Hardly a substantial likelihood. Second, with respect to the LSIR score, the board arbitrarily considered Mr. Coley's LSIR score as a reason to deny parole rather than as a reason to grant parole. The LSIR score should be a reason to grant parole in this case. The board erroneously reached a conclusion that Mr. Coley's LSIR score of 20, and by the way, now it's 18, was evidence that he would recidivate when exactly the opposite is true. Now, in our brief, we actually break it down from the recidivism reports, the cohort reports of their own experts. We break it down. The average LSIR score for recidivists is 23 and above, while the average score for non-recidivists ranges from 20 to 23. That's the statistics. That's the data. Mr. Okoli's score was 20, placing him in a low to moderate risk category, as you discussed, Justice Albin, with Mr. Afron earlier. Dr. Gorwitz's report concluded that Mr. Okoli is a low to moderate risk for future violence with an LSIR score of 19. A low to moderate risk on its face is not evidence of a substantial risk of recidivism on its face. The board ignored compelling evidence that Mr. Okoli is not a substantial risk of recidivism.
Didn't Van Pelt also find that he was a low to moderate risk?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Didn't Dr. Van Pelt also find that?
That is my understanding. We do not have the report. We requested the report and agreed to be part of the consent protective order, consent protective agreement, but we do not have it. But I relied upon what Mr. Afron put in his brief. And my understanding going along with that Dr. Van Pelt also penalized Mr. Okoli for not admitting that he was the shooter, which we know from Cosman and Trantino 6, that is very inappropriate. So I find that kind of interesting, that on the heels of Dr. Gorwitz's amazing glowing report, that Dr. Van Pelt comes in, lambasts him for not admitting that he was a shooter, which has been his position for 50 years, and somehow, but never links, which is the key here. Regardless of all the hype regarding the report, the key is, was it linked to a substantial risk of recidivism? Even Dr. Van Pelt, who put forth not as much of a glowing report as Dr. Gorwitz, clearly indicates that he's not a substantial risk of recidivism, or never concluded that. So,
do you have any final remarks?
I do, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Unless there's any further questions, I do have a few closing remarks. Despite the strong presumption of release, the parole board will never release Mr. Okoli without judicial intervention. This is troubling because Mr. Okoli, an 85-year-old man suffering from cognitive decline, has an exemplary institutional record, which was largely ignored by the board. By any objective measure, the board's decision was arbitrary and capricious and entitled to no deference. And Okoli won a unanimous 3-judge panel of the appellate division, relying upon Trantino 6, recognized that the board, and I quote, may not rely on selective portions of the record that support its determination of likely recidivism while overlooking or undervaluing conflicting information. Judge Rostat's dissent got it right. Okoli's denial of parole was based upon, quote, evidence arbitrarily selected by the board to achieve a desired result. The board failed to meet its burden in Okoli 1 and has failed to meet its burden in the case at bar. Lastly, the public defender, along with 6 other respected amici, including black law enforcement organizations, respectfully request that Mr. Okoli be released immediately so he is not condemned to die in prison.
Thank you, Mr. Russo. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. This case is obviously extraordinary in many ways, but it is nonetheless dictated by ordinary administrative law rules, those rules themselves rooted in due process. As in Trantino 6, in this case, the State Parole Board has acted arbitrarily and capriciously in 3 ways. First, it ignored or undervalued pieces of key information. Second, it focused rather than on the whole record. It cherry-picked the issues that it found and focused arbitrarily on those. And third and finally, it failed to give a meaningful record linking its findings to the statutory rule depriving this court and other courts of the ability to conduct meaningful judicial review. I'd like to start with the aspects that it ignored. And I'll start with the age crime curve. The age crime curve is well established that octogenarians pose a very low risk of recidivism. That's not just established in the social science literature that the American Friends Service Committee brief detailed in exquisite detail. It's also established by this court, most recently in Comer. But as Mr. Russo and Mr. Afrin noted, it's also found by the State Parole Board. So pages 18 and 19 of the American Friends Service Committee brief cite to the State Parole Board reports done in conjunction with the Department of Corrections and the JJC that find that older people are at a substantially lower risk of recidivism. That was ignored. And to the extent there is a rationale the State Parole Board could put forth to say, well, sure, that's the general rule, but it doesn't apply to Mr. Okoli. It's not found in the statement of reasons. And judicial review requires you to evaluate that, to see whether it's entitled to deference. They can't simply ignore compelling data that shows this decreased risk of recidivism. Second, his impeccable institutional record. It's true. The board says, well, we considered that he's been infraction-free since his last hearing. Well, 2 things. First of all, he's not just been infraction-free since his last hearing. He's been infraction-free since I was a child, right? For 30 years, he's been infraction-free. That is a significant predictor of recidivism. And yet, the parole board does not justify why that finding is not virtually dispositive. As Judge Rothstadt noted in dissent, the rationale of the 1979 Parole Act was to incentivize incarcerated people to behave well with this light at the end of the tunnel of parole. And so by not valuing good institutional behavior, the parole board risks undermining that very legislative purpose. Third, they fail to recognize the trusted role he has played in the Bureau of Prisons. It is simply inconceivable that the Bureau of Prisons would assign Mr. Akoli to speak to new people who are newly incarcerated about the risks of recidivism if the BOP viewed him himself as a risk of recidivism. It just defies logic. The LSIR is the last one, and that's been extensively discussed by both of the people who came before me. I'll note that even if it was scored correctly, and Mr. Afrin has explained how that it wasn't, and even if his score remained a 20, and Mr. Russo has told you that it hasn't, it's the second lowest quintile. Low moderate is the second lowest quintile of risk, and the parole board has failed to indicate how that represents a substantial likelihood of recidivism. I'd like to briefly address the three things that they focused too much on. The first thing, and these are from the Attorney General's brief, was that Mr. Akoli could not articulate why he had renounced violence other than with reference to an external event like the election of President Obama in 2008. So a couple things. The first is that's simply not correct. A review of the transcript will see that he talks about the passage of time, he talks about attending programming, and he talks extensively about one-on-one therapy and all the times that he availed himself of that. And in addition to those three things, like many other Americans, he says that the election of President Obama was illustrative to him about a change in race relations in this country. What was thought to never be possible, the election of a black president, had suddenly happened. But that's not reliance on external factors. That's part of a bigger constellation, and frankly, quite common. The second thing upon which they harp, and you've heard some of this today, is about the friendly fire comment. Justice Fernandez-Vina, I know you've reviewed the record, but I'd ask you to look at pages 103, 104, 106, and 159. Those are four of the times he was asked who shot Trooper Forster, and he said he did not know at this hearing. Then later, after he was accused of taking a page out of the Trantino playbook, which is quite disparaging of this court's jurisprudence, he then again is asked, who killed the trooper? He says, I don't know. And Member Jefferson says, I'm not asking you what you know, I'm asking you what you think, at which point he's invited to speculate. He's demanded to speculate. And this court actually has talked about how people respond when their initial in the interrogation context, when you've been told that your initial answer is unacceptable. So I'm talking here about Ludzinski, and you'll find it in footnote 16, where you talk about when the interrogator says, that's crazy, there's this desire to please your interlocutor. Well, here, this isn't an interrogation. This is a parole board. Mr. Akoli knows the parole board controls his fate, and they've just told him, we don't accept your answer. You need to come up with something else. And that's the first and only time, that the friendly
Nonetheless, the answer he comes up with is that nothing to do with his car or anyone in his car. It was friendly fire. Can we agree with that at least?
That was the answer
that's
he
what
gave.
He said, right? Okay.
When asked what he thought, not what he knew, what he thought, that is correct. The third thing upon which the parole board focuses is, I'm going to have to refer to my notes to tell you what the third thing upon which they focus is. The critical thinking class, Justice Albin, and you asked about that. And there was some confusion because it seemed like the member who was asking the question thought that Mr. Akoli had referenced the critical thinking class, had registered for the critical thinking class and then not taken it. Mr. Akoli said, no, I've actually taken that class. And Mr. Afrin's brief and appendix makes clear, based on where he was incarcerated at the time, that it was somewhere between 28 and 33 years ago. CLE class, college class, law school class, could you describe it? I couldn't describe all of them, and that doesn't mean I didn't get anything from it. It just means I can't articulate exactly what it was in that time that I learned. The last thing I'll talk about is where they failed to create a record. And Justice Patterson, this gets to your question about the competing experts. Like Mr. Russo, I haven't seen the expert report, so I'm going to have to talk in generalities. But I can, because I think the answer to your question, Justice Patterson, about whether an administrative agency can credit one expert over another is, yes, they can, if and only if they provide the court with their rationale for doing so. So there might be a reason. We've decided that the theory on which expert B had relied is no longer accepted in the scientific community. Great, that's a judicially reviewable decision. But you can't just say we're going to credit expert A over expert B without explaining the why. And in this case, there was no why whatsoever. And that same problem comes up when you think about...
Let me ask you another question related to that, because again, this case affects future cases. There is a suggestion that the parole board has the obligation to explain what components of an expert's report or testimony it is relying on and what it's not. Now, experts can write 100-page reports. We've all seen them. Is it your position on behalf of the ACLU as amicus that the parole board has to provide that level of detail to say, you know, page 23, subsection 2 says this, we give this X amount of credibility and rely on it to a moderate degree? Or can the parole board say that it relies on the expert's analysis and essentially cross-reference what is obviously a confidential report?
So, Justice Patterson, again, hamstrung by having not seen the report, but I will say, with respect to the parole board or any administrative agency, I don't know that they need to get into line and sentence, or paragraph and sentence, but they do need to tell you why. And here there's nothing. So I don't think it would be sufficient for the parole board, the Department of Health, or any other administrative agency to say, this expert, who incidentally was our expert, who we hired, we are now totally discrediting. But I think unless they tell you why, judicial review of administrative agency action is constitutionally mandated in this state. And as Mr. Afran referenced, it's not about taking them at faith. There's reason. And if they provide reasons, they're entitled to deference. But having failed to do that, they can't. And I want to just say one last thing about reason, and I'll tie it into my last point, which is they also talked about his lack of insight. And as Mr. Russo mentioned, lack of insight is not one of the 24 factors set forth in the administrative code. Not sure what it means, but that doesn't mean they can't rely on it. It's a non-exclusive list. But if they find a lack of insight and explain what it means, their obligation is also to link it to the statute. So to say, we find this lack of insight, it means this, and this is why we think it is predictive of recidivism, of a substantial risk of recidivism, because that, the legislature has told us, is the sole inquiry under the Parole Act of 1979. And having not done that, it deprives courts of the ability to review whether the decision is arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable. I will note, let me actually just end with this and say, I know how carefully you've all reviewed the transcript. I reviewed it again, and I was really struck. It's a long transcript, but if you review those 280 some odd pages and you think, well, this was a fair treatment, this was an earnest attempt to determine whether Mr. Okoli is likely to recidivate, well, then the appellate division opinion must be affirmed. But if instead you see this person then in his 70s, now in his mid-80s, being interrupted constantly, being barraged with questions about Ho Chi Minh and whether Malcolm X had ever renounced violence and the type of hat, was it a fedora or a Superfly hat that he sought to purchase in 1973? If you think those questions weren't probative of his risk of recidivism as an octogenarian, then the appellate division decision must be reversed and Mr. Coley must be paroled.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Brown?
Good morning, members of the court. I consider it a great opportunity to be here to speak on behalf of ACDL, which is deeply concerned about the issues involved in this case. I want one extra minute because I'm going to start by answering one of Justice Albin's questions, and maybe I can have another extra minute at the end to address Judge Patterson's question. But the board's, going to Trantino and Justice Stein's commentary, I quote, the board's reliance on evidence of such remote events was a make-weight to compensate for the lack of substantial evidence to support the board's conclusions. That is one, make-weight being that which you throw on in order to compensate for a lack, in this case, of complying with the standards that are that should be applied and looking at the empirical evidence which Mr. Russo and Mr. Afran so ably described. So the fact that this was a make-weight is the problem. And to address an issue that I think in some ways has been raised by Justice Patterson, another quote, the obvious overlooking or undervaluation of crucial evidence. We have no doubt that its determination based not on a preponderance of all evidence, but on evidence arbitrarily selected to support a desired result is manifestly mistaken and must be set aside. So these are important framing judgments from Justice Stein in Trantino 6, which could have been said and should be said about this case, not to mention the fact that to demonstrate some of the approach by this parole board, at least one parole board member grotesquely distorts the meaning of Trantino 6 and accuses Mr. Accoli of trying to frame his lack of memory because there's some talismanic benefit for any person who does so in a murder case. I submit that what happened here was that the parole board, knowing that it could not, or at least surmising or being in disregard of its obligation to deal with standards and empirical evidence, froze Mr. Accoli in 1974. I guess you would say they froze Clark Squire in 1974, and froze him in that place in a caricature, which wasn't even accurate as to who he was, so it could avoid the ultimate question of whether this then 79 at the hearing and now 85-year-old man is a likely, substantial likelihood for reoffense based on the evidence and the burden. And I think it's important to note what happened here and why that happened. There are things, a few points I'd like to make, because I'm aware and respect the court's time, and I recognize there is a principle in speaking where you say, well, everything's been said, but it hasn't been said by me. So having been preceded by extraordinarily able counsel, I'm going to try to steer into things that I think are relevant and important. A, they shouldn't have been spending time back then. They should be looking at the future events, which is what we asked them to do. We asked them to be Cassandra-like, as at least Justice Albin was in this court in predicting what would happen in this hearing. The question is, he was born in 1937, the year the United States Supreme Court granted relief in Gaines v. Murray, ex rel. Canada, the first in the line of cases that led to Brown. That's the time of his birth. In the same state that gave us significant lynchings and a special holiday designed to acknowledge, they didn't want to acknowledge the end of slavery. So in that state, he went to Prairie View at 16, a land-grant college established in 1876, what we call a historically black university. Then it was a college. And his sister, who is alive today and would be part of his parole package. And it's interesting that his parole plans got all of 7 pages discussion in 286, talking about the future and likelihood of recidivism. His sister is still alive, guided him into mathematics, which is interesting because she was obviously a guiding force in a tradition that goes back a very long time. Now, you see, why is that important? Well, let's take a leap forward to 1963 because, you see, he described to the parole board working for COFO in response to the killings of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner in 1963. Well, why is that relevant? Well, I didn't raise the issue of looking at this man frozen in the past. The parole board did. But then he went to work for COFO, the Council of Federated Organizations. And he's later asked, why didn't you join Dr. King's movement? Another question designed to paint him as a caricature of a violent black revolutionary who is beyond reproach and must demonstrate his own redemption. Guess what? COFO included SLIC, which was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was King's organization. Now you say, should they be called upon to be experts? Well, guess what the majority says in justifying its reliance on this board, that the expertise of persons on the board should include qualified persons with training or experience in law, sociology, criminal justice, juvenile justice, justice, or related branches of the social sciences. So in order to paint him as a man who is irredeemably violent in his pursuit of bettering the race, they ignore what he said a few moments before, either because they didn't bother to know what COFO was, or they didn't want that to be part of the package of humanity that's painted of this man. Because, in fact, he was a person who had multiple strains. I grew up being raised by what were called race people. My father and mother were race men and women. meant you've tried to get an education, you didn't bend the knee on race, and you always thought about the uplift of the race. Indeed, one of the board members says, you were living a good life. Why would you be involved? So they try to merge the notion of a commitment to the race at large with the notion of violence in a way to paint a portrait of an unreconstructed, violent man who can never be let out. The exact language they use on Obama, and we have to say this, we have to read this and emphasize it, your perception that an external factor will dictate your behavioral choices and your failure to provide any examples of how you personally have changed demonstrates a fundamental misunderstanding on your part on the balance of internal and external factors impacting upon your decision-making as it relates to antisocial behavior. Now, I must tell you, I know of no decision-making matrix in any discipline that makes that kind of distinction between external and internal factors. That's a make-weight. That's an overvaluation, and it's a distortion because he said time and time again, including at this board, now I'm older, when asked why he had changed in his view about violence. Aside from his behavior, he said, and I'm older and hopefully wiser, and I learned there are other effective ways of attaining the same thing, in particular with the changes that have come along in society lately. So he said it was something that happened over time, something his behavior demonstrates inside of prison, and they want to say there is some kind of external, internal distinction? What is this about? You know from personal experience what happened when Obama was elected. I got calls from Garveyites, old-time revolutionaries, all kinds of people, including non-black Republicans who said, I don't like his policies, but this is a talismanic moment for America. And even people who posited the unlikely that this was the beginning of a post-racial epoch in America. What kind of distinction are they making about external versus the internal? Have none of us ever been inspired by the act or the word of another person, let alone the conduct of millions of Americans electing a black community organizer and constitutional lawyer to the presidency? Forget his policies. So this is an absurdity. In the name of pseudoscience, which is not identified, of a distinction between the external and internal, which has no historical relevance to him, again, it's part of painting a picture, a caricature of him as an unredeemably violent man. I only have one or two more comments to make, but I would very much like the opportunity to address them. I think that the constant repetition and reference to thinkers who would regard as radical, why is Mao relevant? Why is Ho Chi Minh relevant? Why is Frantz Fanon relevant? Actually, I read all of those guys, although I could never get through Das Kapital out of sheer boredom. But in fact, why is that relevant? An attempt to paint this picture of this person. So you have this radical person, and he is a person who must prove his redemption in political terms in order to be heard, in order to be granted an opportunity to live the last few years of his life in relative freedom. I want to go back for a second. I have two more points to make about this tradition of commitment to race, because that comment from the board member questioning why he would be concerned about others of his race when he was doing so well goes at the heart of something that's deep in our culture. And yes, they had a desire to an obligation to understand this, if they're the kind of experts that the appellate division in this court should rely on and defer to. The tradition of the talented 10th that Du Bois really made popular, that somehow people who got a classical education had an obligation to their people, actually it was an idea that came from white abolitionists that Du Bois popularized. And Charles Hamilton Houston, whose name is on the brief of the black law enforcement people, as for whom the institute that wrote their brief is named, used to say that a lawyer who is not a social engineer is a parasite. That comes out of a culture which says you must be committed. Now, it doesn't mean violent conduct, but it does mean a commitment that has to be separated from whatever acts you may have engaged in at some remote time in your life. But did they parse those differences? No. Did they seek expert help if they didn't know what COFO was, if they didn't know what King's Movement was about? No. And then they asked this man who's been in a low information environment for 40 years to compare the BLA to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. What kind of question is that? That's a make weight. That's designed to steer the conversation away from the core question from which they have a burden. To begin with, political Islam is pretty complicated. A, the term itself is contradictory. And Al-Qaeda and ISIS are deadly enemies. Would a man in a low information environment be prepared to answer that question? Does he have the slightest qualification? Is there a reason to ask it of him? unless it is designed to trap him in this caricature of a 1970s man. And let me finally address the hidden problem in this case. Because the issue is, and this is not an accusation of this parole board, they are human beings who I suspect did the best they could. But is there something about this case that is special? Well, yes, it is. Number one, the killing of a police officer is always of concern to all of society. That makes it special. And indeed, it's no accident that Trantino is our guide in terms of stare decisis. But let me do that which is something that I do in life, and I suppose it is my destiny to always be shaking my fist at this guy. There is the question of race. First of all, as long as we have a prison system that is disproportionately brown and black, then if we have arbitrary judgments, especially in controversial categories, there will be a race effect. And this is pointed out very clearly by Strange Brethren for ACDL, the black law enforcement officers, in their brief. But there is also the question about whether we can be, because this court has steeped itself in implicit bias, inadvertent invocation of racial stereotypes. For the darkest, most threatening racial stereotypes in slavery time has been the rebellious black male. And if you look at the way in which the questioning took place, staccato questioning at an old man who could barely hear in a room where people constantly talked about their inability to hear, about Mao and violence and excessive conversation about offense conduct, and the second category about old ideologies. This is a case that more than others in terms of the notion of precedent to the community at large, as opposed to lawyers who study this, means something. If you spend as much time in prisons as I have, you know, those guys watch and listen to everything you do. Those gals do too.
Mr. Brown, do you have any final?
This is my final comment, Justice, and I appreciate your leniency in allowing me to stretch out just a bit, because I must say to you that I cannot find a basis in reason for the parole board's action, and so I've had to work very hard to see this from other points of view. And I am not accusing anyone of bias, but I am saying if there lies a case which is so redolent of meaning to all and so dangerous, this is the kind of case in which we can abandon the structures that are imposed by law and move in directions that are quite dangerous. And in this case, the notion that the age crime curve alone, coupled with other scores and indicia, are not enough to require the granting of immediate parole and not the death in prison in this man, is compared favorably to the notion that in their inquiry of 286 pages, they looked not at things relevant, but to paint a caricature of the black man who's a threat to us all.
Ms. Cohen?
May it please the court. Your honors, we are here today on appeal as of right. The question before this court is accordingly confined to the issues raised. The question before this court is then initially confined to the issues raised in the dissent. Was the parole board's decision in this case arbitrary and capricious? As the majority decision correctly noted below, the answer is no. The parole board is the agency entrusted to administer the regulatory scheme of parole in the state. Its board members must be uniquely qualified and have training or experience in certain areas such as law, sociology, or criminal justice. They are appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. It is the board's job to be critically concerned with recidivism, and it is tasked with denying parole when appropriate. As this court and others have long recognized, these decisions are necessarily highly individualized and inherently imprecise. Given the agency's expertise, however, a strong presumption of reasonableness and deference must be accorded to them. When reviewing agency actions, courts consider whether the evidence in the record is sufficient to meet the applicable standard of review. In this case, that is whether, based on a preponderance of the evidence, not clear and convincing or beyond a reasonable doubt, but a preponderance of the evidence that there is a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime if paroled. There was ample evidence in supporting the board's decision, as the majority decision found. First of all, the psychological evaluation of Dr. Van Pelt, Mr. Accoli's inability to articulate what he had learned in relevant institutional programming concerning critical thinking, Mr. Accoli's strategic view of violence in that his only specific explanation for turning away from violence was the election of President Obama in 2008, and I know that's objected to, and we can get to that later, Your Honor, but and also his inability to accept personal responsibility for the crime, as evidenced by his pointing to friendly fire as a possible explanation for Trooper Forrester's murder. As required, the board detailed the reasoning behind its decision in a 6-page report, where it made clear that it had comprehensively evaluated the factors required under the regulations and factors that weighed both in favor of and against parole. The board doesn't have a crystal ball, Your Honors, and it won't know for certain what's going to happen in the future. It's a panel of highly qualified experts who had the benefit of the full paper record, the updated psychological report, and an in-person interview where they could press Mr. Accoli to assess his credibility firsthand and seek insight into a deeper understanding of his current thinking regarding violence and what he might do in the future. Mr. Accoli insists that the only objective criteria that they've identified, such as age or institutional behavior, should matter or weigh more heavily. But that is not the law. Rather, the board was acting within its statutory and regulatory authority. It's required to base its decisions on an aggregate of all the relevant factors, which is what it did here. It is the rare case when the judiciary will overturn a parole determination. As courts have previously noted, it should be reserved for those instances when the board's decision was so far wide of the mark that a mistake must have been made. As the majority noted below, that is not this case. I know that there's been some intimations about the parole board's behavior here, and I would just like to state, Your Honors, that people can disagree with the parole board decision. People can strongly disagree with the parole board's decision. But to intimate that the parole board somehow was factoring in irrelevant reasons for its decision is just not supported. So because the board's decision fully comported with well-settled law, this court should affirm. Thank you.
May I ask you, you started your argument by talking about the appeal as of right, and obviously we are limited in to issues raised by the dissent. Did you mean to express to us that there are aspects of the majority's decision or issues that were not raised in the dissent? And I say that because the issues really kind of entwine with one another in this case. Is the entire determination before us, or are there issues that were not contested by the dissent that we should be not addressing in our decision? No,
so they are intertwined with one another, Justice Patterson. I would agree with you there. But what I meant was that the amicus in this case, there are some areas of overlap, but then they also go beyond what was found in the dissent below, and they're arguing for a much larger a sea change, really.
Let me just be more precise. For example, there's a due process issue that was raised before the appellate division,
correct,
by Mr. Accoli. Is it the parole board's position that is something that was not addressed by the dissent and therefore should not be considered by the court?
So the dissent, Your Honor, really focused on the fact that there was no new evidence.
Right, right. It's a very fact specific.
That's very largely, that's what the, that's where the Judge Rostat's objection was.
Right, are you saying the due process case is before the due process issue is before the court or not?
Okay, correct, Your Honor. I would say that with respect to this case, what's before the court is whether there was sufficient evidence in the record to support the parole board's decision.
Thank you.
Ms. Cohen, there's been a lot of discussion about Dr. Van Pelt's report and the statement she makes in her report. How can Dr. Van Pelt's somewhat vague concerns about defendants' possible future political involvement form a basis for a substantial risk of recidivism when Dr. Van Pelt herself, as did Dr. Gorowitz, concluded that he was at a moderate risk to recidivism when the standard is substantial?
Right, Your Honor. So with respect to that, I would just like to note that the LSIR, the level of service inventory score, is moderate. And I know there's a lot of questions about how does that meet the substantial risk factor. So the LSIR is a 54-item actuarial tool that takes into account criminal history, education, financial status, family status, drug, alcohol abuse, societal attitudes, among a whole host of things. I would note that Acoli's score has been in the moderate range since 1994, that it hasn't varied, that in 1994, when he was first up for parole at a time when he'd had numerous infractions, when there had been an escape attempt, he still only scored in the moderate range for the LSIR. And the appellate division below, and these are unpublished decisions, Your Honor, but the appellate division on various occasions has affirmed the LSIR scores, like the upholding or the denial of parole in connection with cases involving LSIR scores as low as 10, which is in the absolute low score, because it was noted in that case that the defendant likely would have scored a 10 even at the time of the murder, that like an LSIR score of moderate is certainly something to take into consideration.
So aside from the LSIR, what in Dr. Van Pelt's report indicates, what facts indicate that he, defendant, is of substantial risk of recidivism? Because a lot of what she says in her report is that he might struggle with parole supervision, that he'll need substantial parole supervision, that given the current state of affairs in the country, he might, you know, be willing to engage in political involvement. What facts did she have in her report to support that, and to support that it would result in a substantial risk of recidivism?
So, Your Honors, to that point, she pointed to a lot of Mr. Acoli's his wooden and rehearsed answers, his inability to really focus, his external internal examination, and she concluded from that he was a risk. Did she use the term substantial risk? She did not use the term substantial risk. But I would note that this court in Trantino and others has talked about the fact that the expert reports are designed to assist the parole board or any agency in connection with making a decision, but they are not the only, you're not to overly necessarily rely on them, that it ultimately is the decision of the agency to make that determination, and that determination was made here by the agency. So it was informed by Dr. Van Pelt's report, but it wasn't completely relying on it when it made its decision. It also relied.
Van Pelt and previously Gorewitz had said low to moderate risk, and that it does not equate to a substantial likelihood of reoffense. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't agree with that. Yes, they said low to moderate risk. Yes, it doesn't use the term substantial, but as I've noted previously, that there are instances when the appellate division has...
Of course, but we...
Sorry, can you let me...
Yes.
Go ahead. Instances what? I'm sorry.
There are instances when the appellate division has affirmed with as low as 10 because, as I noted, and the case is... Sorry, Your Honor, just trying to find it. It's Berta versus New Jersey State Parole Board, where he had as low as 10, because at the time of the murder, he would have scored as low as a 10. So you can't just rely on the fact that there was a moderate or low score to say that there's not a substantial likelihood.
Yeah, so I think that makes a lot of sense, depending upon what the facts are in this case.
Yeah.
But in this case, Acoli had 30 years infraction free, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he was considered a model prisoner, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
His institutional reports had said he displayed a positive rapport with both staff and inmates, correct?
Yes.
He completed at least 100 different programs for self-improvement as well as vocational training, yes?
Correct.
He was a prison representative for the Correction Facilities Social Resource Organization as a result of, quote, his positive institutional record, correct?
Correct.
In 2008, the prison staff reported, that he had demonstrated adequate coping skills and ability to establish positive interaction with others, and that he was expected to be able to transition to the community of parole. Those are from his institutional reports, correct?
Yes.
Those were never referenced at all during the hearing, were they?
No, they were in, the board. I mean, they were in the record.
Nor were the 100, more than 100 programs that he had taken, other than the so-called criminal thinking one, correct?
Yes.
Although
I would note, Your Honor, that of most of those, as noted in the record, were educational in nature, and Mr. Okoli was certainly highly educated. I'm not disparaging the fact that he took educational classes, but educational classes alone, you know, aren't really designed for him to help you.
The board has an obligation to review all of it. Am
yes,
I right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Does the board have an obligation to acknowledge in a hearing or in a decision all of what it reviews?
So that, to your point, Your Honor, the answer is no on that. McGowan versus, and I'm sorry, let me just grab the cite to it. The McGowan case says that the board's determination of parole is not required, and this is, I'm sorry, McGowan versus New Jersey State Parole Board, 347 New Jersey Superior 544, which is an appellate division 2002 case, specifically says that they're not required to consider each and every one of the 24 factors enumerated in the administrative code when reaching their decision. It's a non-exhaustive list, and they can take others into consideration. Rather, it must consider the factors that are applicable in the case.
Right, right. But this is a little bit a different question, because I think the focus of a lot of the discussion today is on specific facts that were either cited in the hearing or not cited, or in the report or in the decision and not in the decision. No question the board has the obligation to read the entire record, to be aware, for example, of all of the courses that Mr. Okoli took, correct?
Correct.
Does the board have to mention them or cite them in order to properly exercise its authority?
I'm sorry, when you're saying, Justice Patterson, you mean cite all
cite the,
of the courses?
Cite them, talk about the X number of courses or specifically?
No, Your Honor, they're required under the regs to cite the reasons for their denial. And they are required by, you know, McGowan and others just to make sure that they've identified the factors that they're going to rely on. To have to, like, do this huge voluminous report, that's never been required of them, nor to do that linking, Your Honor.
Forget about the report for a second. This court sent this case back for a hearing before the board.
You did, Your Honor.
And the board spent about three pages that I could see, three solid pages, on his parole plan to live with his daughter and his grandchildren in Brooklyn, and spent like 10 pages on his Superfly hat. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Yes.
And there was mention that there was lack of acceptance of responsibility. I've gone through this transcript, and in terms of his disavowing nonviolence, page 131, I learned that there are other effective ways of attaining the same thing.
Nonviolence.
Thank you. That the same thing can be attained through nonviolent means. He said, I don't advocate and condone violence. He said, violence is wrong, page 186. I fully embrace living a peaceful lifestyle. I'm turned away from violence. 280, we have to find a way to deal with the situation without using violence. Isn't that indicative of things that he's learned during the 49 years that he has been incarcerated?
So to that point, Your Honor, and I would hearken back initially, because I didn't answer specifically when you had asked before about his long-standing, his 49 years in prison and all of the classes he had taken, and, you know, what he had learned, and the fact that he wasn't violent, and how did that, you know, shouldn't that factor in? And I think Judge Boehm in the dissent in Trantino accurately noted that being a model inmate does not indicate necessarily being a model citizen, and had cited to a whole bunch of studies. So the fact that Mr. Okoli is, you know, a model inmate and has taken lots of classes and is doing well certainly is a factor to consider, no doubt, and the parole board is not disputing that. But to say that it should be dispositive or should be accorded more weight here is inaccurate. And I'm sorry, you look like you wanted to ask a question, Your Honor. So I'm saying, and with respect to the question of him accepting responsibility, it is the parole board's job to push. So was a majority, they are the experts here. This is their job. They have thousands of parole hearings a year. They deal day in and day out with inmates who come before the parole board and are going to say, I accept responsibility and I am not going to commit crimes in the future. And did they push Mr. Okoli and were they terse and was it this give and take? I think, yes, they did. I think as this court recognized in Trantino 6 when it remanded, there's got to be that dynamic interaction with the full board because the full board.
He accepted it at least in the only way that a person can at a hearing through his words. He said, page two, I'm responsible for the death. He said, I'm very sorry and I regret the murder of her husband. I regret my role in it. I apologize deeply. 204, 205, I'm responsible for it. I deeply regret it. I apologize deeply for it. I really do have sympathy and remorse for what I've done. And in his final statement on page 282, I deeply regret his murder. I offer my deepest remorse and sincere apology to Trooper Forster's family.
So to that point, I guess I would say, Your Honor, that it's clear the parole board did not believe Mr. Okoli, right? They didn't believe his sincerity or his remorse. They were acting as fact finders, which happens every day in jury trials and bench trials by judges when someone comes before you and they make statements and they say, I accept responsibility or blank. They're required to make a determination about that. And that's what they did here. And that's within their statutory authority. And it should be accorded as much weight as other evidence. It's not what Okoli would like to do is to parse out, to kind of divide and conquer and say, it's only age that should matter. And I know that's in amicus briefs. It's only, you know, my time in jail, these factors that should matter and not the whole package. And the statute and the regs say that it's going to be.
What is the whole package that this 85-year-old man who apparently is on the threshold of dementia, had hearing loss at the hearing, is a substantial likelihood, other than the fact that he's found to be emotionless, this is rehearsed, he doesn't have insight. What is there?
So, Your Honor, with respect to the dementia issue, and I just want to push back on it a little bit because I think that that is a misstatement of the record. Dr. Van Pelt, in her opinion, and it's at CA 81, she does note that the prison case manager noted recent changes in processing and retaining of information. He looks confused and is asking to repeat questions. However, she noted that if you go to CA 84 in the record, current memory concerns are not to be viewed as authentic symptoms of dementia. Given his age and family history of Alzheimer's, it may develop in the future if daily functioning suffers a decline, but not at this time. And with respect to that, I was going to say, Your Honor, that both Dr. Gorwitz and Dr. Van Pelt noted that he was highly intelligent during their interview process with him. So the dementia aspect, I just wanted to push back on, and I apologize, Your Honors, because that's prompted me to forget what your main question was. So,
well, what crime is he expected to commit if, at the age of 85, he's released to live with his daughter and son-in-law and his grandchildren?
Your Honor, the crime, it can be, it's just a crime, right? It doesn't have to be, again, and I think Bomikas, or I apologize, it might have been Mr. Afrin, had noted, like, he's not going to be shooting a trooper again, potentially, on the highway. That's not the evidence here. It's whether there's a potential for a substantial crime. And so the board looked at his current views on violence and what they perceived to be, you know, his current views on violence. And when they pushed, as they had to here, what Mr. Okoli articulated is that he believed there had been some passage of time that, you know, with President Obama being elected, that showed a change. And that was all he could cite to. And I know he says, well, I took classes and everything, but when they pressed him on what did you learn?
The presumption is on the board to show that there's a substantial likelihood that he will commit a crime. I'm asking you, like, what crime is it expected that Mr. Coley is substantially likely to commit if he's released to his daughter and his grandchildren?
So I can't say what crime he actually would necessarily commit, Your Honor. I don't know. Like I said, the parole board doesn't have a crystal ball as to what specific crime. But as far as potentials for crimes here, and let's go back. And then, so the factors are, this wasn't a crime of youthful indiscretion. Mr. Coley was nearly 37 years old when he committed this murder. So the age factor, and I know that Coley and Amicus spent a lot of time talking about, well, you know, with ages that the curve goes down and that you're less likely to, you know, commit a crime when you're older. But according to their own reports, you know, that the curve starts to decline well before you're 37 years old. And Mr. Coley committed a crime at that time. So the age...
We're 49 years out.
Yes, and 49 years out.
We know the horrible, heinous offense that was committed. No one is diminishing that. No one can downplay that. The question now is, what substantial likelihood of his committing a crime now? What is it?
The substantial likelihood, Your Honor, is that because he can't articulate really, his view of violence is strategic. And what I mean by that, and I know that the board used internal and external, but his view, if you go through the record, when he's talking about when he had the gun, right, and he had to carry the gun way back in the 70s because there was the potential that, you know, he could be in a gunfight. And so he was justified, and he said early in the transcript, like in shooting the trooper because they were afraid the trooper was going to shoot them, right? So he was engaged in a battle. So he viewed it as necessary and strategic at the time because of a charge situation. Then he claims that he has learned since then that violence is wrong, but when pushed on it, all he could really reference, I mean, he says, I've attended classes and I've learned one-on-one with the therapist, but when they push him, okay, what specifically did you learn? He says, well, it's really more about President Obama being elected in 2008, and I've learned that society, you know, can change. And that's laudable and great, but that's still going.
He said also, if you look, I've read the entire, I'm older, I'm wiser, I renounce violence. I think this is scattered throughout the transcript we sang. What more can he do? So, other than 30 years of infraction free, since you don't seem to credit his deeds and you don't credit his words.
I think Your Honor, they have to look at the whole thing. And they credited the deeds. They go, you know, the factors, both pro and against. But they are tasked with making credibility assessments as well. And so merely saying, I accept and I know, isn't necessarily going to be sufficient, and they didn't find it sufficient here. They found him to be clearly unbelievable. I'm sorry, Your Honor.